There's only one job I've had my whole life that was not soccer, and I worked the gift shop at the Washington Monument the summer after my first year at NC State down in Washington, D.C. But besides that, every job I had, I worked for my high school coach, Scooter Skaggs, starting when I was like 12, 13 years old, working his camps. I quote unquote babysat doing private training sessions for kids when I was a teenager, 15, 16. You know, you work camps, you coach teams. I worked at a soccer shoe store. Every other job, except for that one summer for about two and a half months, revolved around soccer. And it's brought me to all sorts of wonderful places in the world. I have most of my friends because of it. I mean, it's like I said, I'll try to not get emotional, but the reality is, it's because also my family became a soccer family. Mm-hmm. So my brother Quinn started it the following year. His coach, because it was just a dad in the neighborhood, took a job someplace else where the family was moving. My father, who was a research scientist who worked for National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, got so tired of my brother moping around because they didn't know who the coach would be, said,
I'm going to coach.
Yeah, you know what? If you can't find a coach, I'll do it. And my brother got on the phone, started calling all his friends. He said, my dad's going to coach. My dad, being the research scientist, what did he do? He researched the game. He started getting books. He befriended a wonderful man and a great coach, Graham Ramsey, who lived in our neighborhood, and they would drink beers out on the porch and talk soccer. And my father ended up coaching multiple youth teams, obviously my brothers, and then I played 2 years up with that team, which helped my development.
You had more than a knack. You played. If you were five or six and playing.
Yeah, I started playing up with them when I was 7 or 8, and they were 9 and 10. Okay. And then I played my own age group 1 year when they were moving to classic level soccer. And to be fair, it was just apparent it was not good for anybody for me to be in that league. Funny side story, I remember my brother Quinn had scored, I think it was 18 goals in a season the year before, I think in an 8-game season or something like that. And my dad, again, we were playing for another local team. I was playing my own age group, and the coach of my team's oldest son played on my father's team, and so we knew them quite well. And I was at 18 goals, and he told the coach of the other team to put me in goal so that I wouldn't break my older brother's record. And his name was Dr. Sherwood. Dr. Sherwood's response was, I can do that, John, but we still have 4 games left in the season.
So the record is yours. The record is yours.
So I didn't break it on that day, but I did break my brother's record. My whole family embraced the game, and we grew up with it. And my dad actually became a very successful coach and coached multiple state cup championship teams. Some with me and my brother on it. After I had left, I was the baby. He would go back and take a team and form a team at like 10 years old, form the team out of tryouts, form them at 10 years old. And then when they get to about 14 or 15, he'd pass them on. And then my mom actually became a commissioner for MSI, which was Montgomery Soccer Incorporated, which was the rec league. That's how it all started. And I have a lot of quality coaches throughout the year. You know, I said Dave Scooter Skaggs, my high school coach, was probably the biggest one overall in regards to, I went to his camp that first year when I was 5 or 6 years old. They let me in early because it was like the age group was 8. Woodward High School, those guys were my idols. I'd go to every game. I was the ball boy. I mean, this went on for years until I played for Woodward, until Woodward actually closed my sophomore year, and we won the state championship that last year. So Scooter Skaggs, a huge part of the development process for me, as was my father. Another one, Corky Logsdon, who coached me. I went back to my own age group in 7th, 8th grade and the beginning of 9th. And again, if you look routinely, that's when players kind of have to play their own age because puberty hits, right, man, and it's a big jump at those ages. And then I would have to say, you know, the coach that made me see the game most like a professional and really started to get the most out of me as a quote-unquote protege was Sonny Askew. Sonny played for those old Washington Diplomats, played with Johan Cruyff, Johan Niskens, and played with some big-time players. And he just brought this wonderful joy to the game. Anybody that played for Sonny says Sonny's the best coach they ever had because He made you see it different. He challenged you. He built the confidence, and he was just fun. And so I would say he had the biggest impact on me as a coach today, because he was also an unbelievable player with wonderful feet and a wonderful imagination. I think I probably emulate him as a coach more than anybody else. All those models, all those reasons, all those rhymes. They stay priceless, they come right back, right on time. You are a teacher, preacher, mother, father, a lot less taker than giver. A keeper of secrets and constantly making believers out of quitters. And for all of your time and your heart and your soul, you deserve a lot more. Thanks again. We'll never forget you, coach.
The teams that he coached you on, were they players of the same ilk as you? Was it players with the same ability, or there was a big range?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to be fair, I joined that team when I was 15 years old, and it was a U19 team. Things were different back then.
Gotcha.
You only played for a national championship at U16 and U19. So a lot of the better teams didn't even play, like U17, U18, or the better players. So I came in as the youngest player in that team and then finished, you know, at U19. Well, actually finished U18. U19, I played for a different team, for the Bethesda Lions. Dennis Hamlett, who's now the technical director for New York Red Bull, was one of my teammates on that team. Rudy Meredith, who's been a longtime women's coach at Yale. There are a lot of quality players on those teams.
Did that team get to, like, national?
We unfortunately lost in the regionals every time. We played in three straight State Cup finals and won two of them. The one year we lost in penalty kicks to Union Lancers, who was coached by Bob Bradley, who ended up being the World Cup coach. Richie Williams still gives me shit about that. Another year, we didn't even get out of group play. It was one of those, you know, disappointment where you expect to do better. But we were a really entertaining team to watch and a really fun team to play for. And then obviously went from there to NC State.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Played for the Pack.
Oh, whoop, whoop.
Some great years there. Won an ACC championship, Final Four appearance.
Should have won.
And should have won.
Penalty kicks.
You know, lost in penalty kicks again. My U19 year, I played for a team called Bethesda Alliance, and we lost in penalty kicks in the national semifinals. 4 months later, lost in national semifinals, UCLA in penalty kicks. A guy named Brad Friedel stopped one of the PKs. But I'll tell you what, that was actually one of the coolest experiences I've ever had, and it wasn't that day. It was 2 days later when we walked into the stadium and the game had just started, the final game between, I believe it was UCLA and Rutgers. And we were at USF and there was about 6,000 people at the game. And we got a standing O from the fans when we walked in because they appreciated the way we played against UCLA. Because we were very entertaining. That was probably the first time I really had chills on the back of my neck, back of my spine, like, whoa, this is pretty cool.
Is that game on YouTube somewhere? People really should go back and look at that game. For a long time, it was like one of the teams that had made it the furthest in terms of NCAA at NC State. Somebody has to have that game.
I don't know where it is. It might be in Henry Gutierrez's library someplace.
When I first came down, there were a couple of games that I saw upstairs on VHS in one of the storage rooms at Reynolds, and I'm going, nobody's ever going to see these. So I took them.
Yeah, you might have it,
Rod. I might look around and see if I have that game.
Some unbelievable players on both teams.
And that's why I wanted people to
see
it, because you look at that team and you say basically the U.S. national team for the next like 3 or 4 years, at least half.
A number of them.
A half.
Yes.
So Friedel, Kobe Jones.
Yeah, Roy. Chris Henderson.
Chris Henderson.
Obviously, Henry and Dario.
Was Hiddick?
Frankie, I actually think, was a part of that team but was injured.
Okay.
Billy Thompson, the wee man up front. I think Salcedo was a freshman maybe that year. I'm not sure who's the coach there now.
So when you say entertaining and the fans appreciated it, what about that 1990 NC State team was so different than what everybody else was doing?
We were electric, man. We had so much pace that I was not part of that conversation when it comes to pace.
So what position did you
play? I just played my role. So I was the starting right midfielder in a 4-3-3. Dario Bros and Henry.
So George Tarantino was 20 years ahead of his time.
Yeah. George was a bit ahead of his time. You know, we were an interesting 4-3-3, but we were a 4-3-3. Tommy Tanner played wide right as a winger. Roy Lassiter as a center forward. Alex Sanchez as the left winger. You know, that was the offensive attack. Scotty Schweitzer, we played more of a sweeper back then. I actually believe Kurt Johnson, my president of NCFC, was the right back in that start in that game. Dwayne Hampton.
D-Train.
And I think David McCurdy might have started at left back in that game. And then David Allred was the keeper. Like I said, great team. Great. And again, you know, you talk about what soccer has brought me. Well, half those names I go out and have beers and wings with.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a joy to play for so many different teams and to stay connected with them and be friends to this day. And I hate to say it again, but it comes back to the winning aspect. I have found out that the teams that win tend to...
Friendships stay a little longer.
Tend to stay friends a little bit longer. Yeah. You know, you have that sense of accomplishment. You've done something together. You get brought back for honorary weekends, you know, stuff like that. There are some major benefits to winning, so let's not forget it's part of the game.
So what was available to you? Here's a guy who lived and breathed this game since you were five, obviously had the facility to do it, and was always progressing, playing on older teams. So you're done with college, but there is no soccer, at least the way that Askew had it with the Diplomats or NASL. Mm-hmm. So what was the plan?
Well, there wasn't really a plan. That was it. I mean, the USISL was just starting. You know, played a couple years for the Raleigh Flyers. First year it was amateur, second year it was pro. And I was finishing up my degree as a fifth-year student the year I played pro. That was actually a pretty cool year, to be honest, because in that spring semester, I was essentially living the college life, taking only two classes to graduate, playing soccer, coaching soccer. I was actually coaching Senator Edwards' son's team at the time. His wife was my team manager, which is crazy, right? That was a cool experience because I was getting paid like $125 a game. And we were playing probably 2 to 3 games a week. And I was still under a partial scholarship. And I was getting paid.
Money was good.
Hey, when you can go to Barry's and have a dollar at the door in nickel drafts and you're making close to $1,500 a month all of a sudden, life has changed for you. So it was pretty neat. And then also, you know, one of the hardest things I went through was I did my hamstring my senior year in college. So when you talk about character and dealing with adversity, you know, and going back to everything now, it was the first time I actually remember there was an article in the Technician was like, you know, out of the shadows into the spotlight because Henry was gone and Dario was gone and Roy was gone. And, you know, I made the MetLife tournament team.
The Duke.
Yeah, you know, so it got off to a good start. And because I really was just kind of a role player. You know, I'd have a couple big games here and there, but it was more about Roy and Dario and Henry, as it should be. They were unbelievable players. So my senior year, looking it to be my breakout year and not knowing if there's going to be any future because there were no leagues, you know. And I did my hamstring against Wake Forest at home. Then would keep trying to come back and re-injure it. I was on the sideline for our quarterfinal loss to Davidson and penalties, and I was in tears afterwards. So I was probably more heartbroken than anybody because I'm thinking my career just ended on the sidelines, you know? So to deal with that, to work to get strong again, to get fit, to have this USISL team local, to be able to play with guys like Jason Kreiss at Duke and Berhalter at UNC and the Vagnon and Kepner brothers. It was a really cool experience to get us together. And then we go the next year to go pro. It was like, okay, here we go. I'm really enjoying this to the point where I don't want this to stop. And Henry and Dario were both playing in France at the time. So I went to France, both myself and Scotty Schweitzer went to France. Scotty had already gone. I'd stayed longer to get my degree. Bounced around for just under 3 months. and worked the visa. The 3-month visa was about to run out. It was bad timing. Didn't, you know, you don't, again, you don't have the guidance that you have now. That I went over at the end of the Flyers season, which happened to be late August, early September, which happened to be the end of their preseason when the season just started. You're not signing players then. You're not going to come in as an American where you don't have the respect that we have now. When, by the way, back then there was only, I think, 2 foreigners allowed on the whole team, and that was foreigners, anybody outside your country, not Euro, foreigners. And they've been there for 6 weeks in preseason working hard and doing everything. It was naive to think that I could do that, but I just didn't know any better. But stayed with Dario, stayed with Henry. Got an opportunity to come back and play for an indoor team called the Cleveland Crunch. I grew up in Maryland, so I'm always aware of the indoor teams. The Baltimore Blast was a team I used to go watch play. And Tommy Tanner, former Wolfpacker from that ACC championship team, was playing for Cleveland. They just won the championship. Said, you know, we need some players, man. Come out here. I went out there, and within a matter of 2 weeks, Scotty was back from France, and within a matter of a month, Henry got out of his contract, and we were all together playing for the Cleveland Crunch.
NC State Part Deux indoor.
NC State There's Part Deux.
Please look on YouTube, folks. It's got to be Cleveland Crunch. You guys won. What years?
Yeah, so we got there in 94, but we won it in 95, I believe. In our second year there, win a championship. Because we lost in the semifinals my rookie year. But the second year there, to win a championship together after just missing out against UCLA, after traveling the world, after not knowing what's going on, I met my wife, Lita, that year. You know, and to meet your future wife and celebrate your first championship with 3 of your best friends was really a special moment. It was really, really cool. From there on, really continued to do the indoor-outdoor thing. That was, I believe, the year that MLS was starting. Played a year for the Wilmington Hammerheads, which was very enjoyable. The next year, came to the beach and played, made it to the semifinals of the, again, I think it was USISL then.
But give people a sense, so the indoor season would start the year, and it would end around with...
The indoor season would end based on how far you went in the playoffs, okay. And then they started to shrink that down. But for us, it would end in late April.
And then you go immediately to an outdoor team.
Yeah, and those teams were already starting up. So you either had a contract in place or you went and earned one very quickly. And that was hard sometimes because, again, here's the outdoor teams are just really starting to form. And these people, even though indoor soccer was providing financial revenue for most of the people in this country for a long period of time, and certainly better contracts than what was getting paid in that USISL league. The people involved with USISL really knew nothing about the indoor players. For a lot of guys, it wasn't like you just had a contract waiting. And the nice thing about indoor, though, is that if you don't go play outdoor, summer's when all the camps are. So a lot of guys made
thousands of dollars.
A lot of money. Thousands of dollars. Doing indoor and just doing camps, or also coaching, because a lot of indoors, you know, especially in where indoor was popular, is kind of the winter
Midwest,
regions, Midwest
North.
And stuff. So you can coach soccer, not necessarily even camps, but all the club scene. And the biggest names in those areas were the indoor players. So in those areas, indoor soccer players did very well.
Indoor to outdoor, obviously the size and what have you, but how different was it the first time?
I don't know. I mean,
soccer.
No. I mean, you know, we play 5-a-side every day at NC State.
Right.
You know, you play small side. It just had boards. Indoors, it's a tighter area. You got to have a clean touch. You know, you're not getting away with a bad touch.
And it's physical almost encouraged physical.
Back then.
For the spectator.
Back then,
almost
it was
seemed
a spectator
like for the spectator,
sport.
Right.
That's absolutely.
Right. It's gladiator shit.
Absolutely. I'll say one thing is, you know, I never expected to have an quote-unquote indoor career, but man, it was exciting. You're in an arena that holds 8,000 people and 7,000 people are there, it is loud, it is exciting, and it's high energy, it's high impact, you know. To play for the best team your first 2 years in the league helps too. You get a taste for it, you know, you get a taste for winning again.
Is indoor still big now, or is MLS?
There's still an indoor league, but the outdoor leagues definitely overshadow it now, okay. Mainly because of MLS. Because of the emergence of MLS and the money that's involved with it, that means that more people are playing for USL teams, NASL teams, with the ambition of playing MLS, and not as many guys are getting into the indoor scene. You know, when I first came out, the best players were playing indoor and outdoor, and they were making a good living because they're going back and forth. Now, granted, there wasn't much of an off season. You're playing 11 months out of the year. When MLS first started, there are countless players that were making more money playing indoor and outdoor in the lower league than what MLS was willing to offer, because again, it was they were in the early stages, and that sense of entitlement. If you don't take this contract, there's another person that will, right? You know, it's like, hey, we'd love to have the best players out there, but it's not that important as just having players and having people starting to come to the game.
For some reason, in my mind, I'm thinking indoor, and specifically in the Midwest, it's like a lot of Polish names and Eastern Europeans were the big guys that were getting the money. At least that's what I want to remember. Yeah. Were there Americans like you and, you know, Henry and Dario and Scotty who were forming the basis of most of the teams?
I think a lot of the superstar players were still internationals then. But,
so it's the same model.
But the core of the team became much more American. Okay. Yes. For a number of years, it was heavily foreigners playing indoor soccer as well, because there just weren't Americans playing soccer. I mean, Ricky Davis was like the one guy, and Kyle Rowe Jr., you know. But when I was in the league, that's when it was more of an influx of Americans. My two teammates, two of the best ever played, Zoran Karic and Hector Marinaro. But they also grew up playing with Steve Zongel, you know, and Bronco Sagoda and stuff. They were back in the day, Kai Hoskley. They were back in the day when it was littered with foreigners. Gotcha. They were kind of the top guys when we came in.
When did you decide to transition coaching? Because, I mean, you were at NC State a couple years before me because you're older than me. but I would hear stories about, you know, that lineage of players, Dario, Henry, you. Yeah. And then obviously you were gone doing the indoor thing and, you know, getting yourself situated with the family. And then when I sort of got reintroduced, basically, I'm not even reintroduced because I never met you when you came back here and were coaching. When did you go, all right, I've done the soccer thing?
I wouldn't say it was a transition. It was a change in focus because I was coaching all that time.
Okay.
I was, like I said, I mean, my dad was a coach. I grew up coaching soccer camps. I always did stick. I coached the Castle team before I left. So outside of my rookie year, I think I always coached. I realized, one, I truly enjoyed it, but also that I had a knack for it. The teams that I would coach were doing pretty well. Or, and again, how do you judge success? Right. Doing pretty well. They got better. You know what I mean? And so, therefore, it became a part of what I did. It became a part of my decision making. You know, like, okay, I'm gonna go play here. What extra money can I make too? You know, as far as club soccer. I stopped playing outdoors for a bit because that way I could get rest, you know, as I was getting older. And I was started my own camps. The business of soccer and coaching became something I started to do more, but had always done. And then reality is I always had a goal to play at least 10 years. And in my ninth and 10th year playing, we won back-to-back championships with the Baltimore Blast. I had been helping at Johns Hopkins as well and coaching at a club called Free State in Bowie, Maryland. My good friend Patrick Noel, got to give him a shout. And at that point, had my oldest daughter, Macy, who's just walked in, and looking at to what is next, because you know it's going to run out at some point. Could I have kept playing? Absolutely, I could have kept playing. I was, you know, in the starting rotation in two championship teams. But it was catching up with me. The grind, the day-to-day grind of fighting through injuries and going through practice, Never the games. I love the games. To this day, if I could practice once a week and play games, I would do it. But that and the idea that we had just started a family, and like I said, it's going to come to an end, started to kind of look around, what's next? And interestingly enough, Aranda, you say that because I contacted George Tarantini about coming back, because he had asked me to have a role when I first left, and I said, no, I want to play. And he said, no, I've hired the Rondé Act.
No!
You know?
So this is early 2000s? Because yes, I came back in 2002. The reason I got the opportunity was a guy was, you know the story, that guy was, well, Kurt was left. Kurt Sokolowski was there, had just left. And I think he offered the opportunity to a guy that was a freshman my senior year. And the story goes that this guy was driving from Colorado with his fiance. They got to Kansas. They both decided, I'm not going to do this. And in November of 2001, I got married, and my then wife, she was still working at NC State, was going to move to New York, and we were going to start our life up there. I just, because I would visit her maybe once a month or once every 2 months down here, and I just happened to be on a visit. The spring of 2002, I'm like, of course I'm going to say hello to the coach. And he's like, Luke, I got this guy. You know, in the job. I offered him the job. He's about to come over here.
Well, this would have been probably around January of 04. Maybe fall of 03 when I first started talking to him, probably. Okay. Fall of 03.
I started in June of 2002.
So but you'd been there about a year. So that's about right.
I'm trying to think who else was there then. Eric? I think Eric Lasseter might have been. Might have been helping out. But
So George said, you should maybe contact John Rennie. At that time, John Rennie ran Triangle Football Club. Marlo was a part of it as a coach. I met with him. I met with Jay Howell at Castle while I was in town. Always liked John Rennie. He was always a class act. You know, he's good friends with George. And when I got there, Al Pastore, who was my owner and coach with the Wilmington Hammerheads,
was an assistant at Duke, right?
Was an assistant at Duke, and what we called the consigliere for TFC. He was kind of the guy behind the scenes that helped with the business and stuff. And long story short, I mean, when I got home, they essentially were offering me a job to come down as a director of coaching. And I was kind of taken aback. I said, you know, how would Marlo feel about that? And he said, oh, I didn't tell you. We want you and Marlo to do it together.
So, I mean, for people who don't know, Marlo Campbell, DeJuan Bader.
We came in together. We were freshmen together at NC State.
So you worried about taking a position from a friend who had been established here.
Who had already been a part of TFC and coaching with them. And so when he said that, no, we want you to do it together, I called Marlo, and listen, it was the freaking mob, DeJuan.
Every time you try to get out, NC State keeps pulling you back in, DeJuan.
So, you know, it was a nominal salary, but it was 04, and it was a director of coaching role when these were just becoming popular with youth clubs. And Marlo said, I think we can do a lot with this club. At the time, there were only 440 kids at the club. And he said, I think we can do a lot with this club, and I think it would be really fun. In my mind, I was sold, and then we won another championship with Baltimore. And I knew in the locker room, as the tears coming down my face, I knew I was done. I had made the decision at that point that can't get much better than winning two in a row, having a job opportunity back in Raleigh, where some of my best friends are, to run a soccer club. Driving all the old men crazy. Two years later, Carolina Railhawks named a professional team here. Scotty Schweitzer, former roommates, the head coach. Damon Nahas, another NC State guy's assistant coach, there to help out with tryouts. But even then, thought, okay, this is it. Their second year in, got asked to be the U23 coach. Did well with that. And then the next year, they hired Martin Rennie as the head coach.
No relation to John.
He asked me to be part of things. I actually purposely just stayed away from it because two former teammates had been let go. But I really enjoyed the U23 aspect of it and had a real positive experience with that. Lost in the PDL semifinals. Some great players on that team. A lot of future MLS guys. And then Martin Rennie asked me again to come on board. So I came on board as an assistant with the pro team, head coach of the U23 team, and at that time still the director of TFC. So that's when I was wearing a lot of hats. Yes. And that's when we created the Atlantic Soccer League as well and was president of that and then later commissioner. So I was wearing a number of hats for a period of time.
I remember looking at you at that point and I'm going, this guy is not frazzled, but you can see there's a lot of wheels spinning because, I mean, there's a lot of things going on.
There were, but it was all to benefit soccer and it was all soccer related work. And so when you love something that much and a lot of it was new organizations, right? Mm-hmm. Helping to create the footprint. And when you see that type of development, especially with TFC, like I said, 450 kids, when we left, it was 2,400 kids. I failed to mention our experience with the NC Alliance, as I told you before, it was mm-hmm. one of my most enjoyable things working with, you know, you, Henry, Stephen Glass, Ronnie, Cisse. And that was the first time that I felt like, because, you know, when you take over a club like
TFC. I just realized it's all NC State guys except for Stephen.
Yeah, they were. And that's what I mean. You know, when we talk about culture, right? You talk about culture. That was the first time you're bringing two clubs together, the top players from those two clubs and other players in the community. We had the crazy uniforms. It came with the red, blue, and yellow. They stood out. So when you went to a tournament, you knew who the Alliance were, one, by their appearance, but two, by the way they played. It was really the first time that I felt like there was a group of teams, a collaborative effort that everybody was doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you remember, like we had, you know, in nights where all the defenders, U15 to U18, all that worked together, midfielders together, forwards together. So when you would cover my team, it wasn't a foreign notion. It was what you said mimicked what I would say, because it was all very familiar. One of the best compliments I've had as a quote unquote director from a technical perspective was Rob Ryerson at an Atlantic Soccer League event says, I love watching these NC Alliance teams. And he said, it's not just the crazy uniforms. He said, all of your teams look the same. He said, they pass, they dribble, they're ethnic, there's black, there's Hispanics, there's white. You know, you don't think about that. Right. You don't think about that when you're putting them together. But it also mimicked the coaching staff. And there's Hispanics and blacks and whites. And it was completely integrated, yet all four teams played a very similar style of play. And it went back to that entertaining NC State soccer. It was the first real steps of bringing those two clubs together and doing more with one another. So that was really rewarding for me. Okay. And obviously having you and Ronnie involved was great too.
So now we have a situation, you're with the professional club here, NCFC, and then the same sort of merger has happened on a grander scale. So TFC went from 400 to, when you left, is it 2,500?
About that, yeah.
And then now, merging with Castle, we're what, 12,500 kids?
Something like that, yeah.
So you did that and you saw the benefit of doing that. What do you think about the merger?
I personally think it was the smartest thing to do. To me, it's a no-brainer, you know. It's not just for the top players. There's obviously an added benefit for them, but the reality is there are more good regional teams now than there were. There's more players that are playing 15 minutes from their own house,
right,
with players of equal level than there would be if we didn't do that. Not to mention, they're able to do that because of the facilities that when you add both groups together, shared facilities means that there's normally a venue a little bit closer to you, a quality venue that you can have these practices in. The teams that realistically still travel the most are the high-end teams because they're all in, you know, and they also know the benefits of it. They know college is around the corner and the possibility of playing pro soccer. But in general, I think it was a great idea. And I got to tell you, I find it really rewarding to step on the field and see the pro banner and the pro colors and the pro badge on all these kids. Right. You know, look, I found it rewarding anytime I'd pass a TFC magnet or a kid wearing a TFC shirt as well. So don't get me wrong. But to know that we're all working towards a common goal now, and I say that meaning like John Bradford and Paul Forster and the guys at Castle that, you know, everybody's, oh, I'm not sure I like those guys. We don't like them because you're competing against them. You're not supposed to like the guys you're competing against. But now that you're in the same room and working on a common goal and to see all these guys working together and talking fondly of one another, and for me, I'm more on the periphery as an advisor, you know, this has been an awesome venture. And to think that we're only a few months into it is really crazy. So I think you're heading in the right direction. Like I said, the one place where I feel we can continue to do more is to have that continuity, that commonality, where there's a very strong philosophy from the pro team that funnels down to at least the academy teams because they wear our jerseys and they're more associated with us. And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breeze. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breeze.
You mentioned that you've been assistant coach for the U19s. You were in France.
Czech Republic with the 18s. Won a tournament there. Yeah.
So what's next?
The one thing I love more than soccer is my family and their happiness. And we love Raleigh. We love this community. Okay. You know, went to school here, left for 10 years, came back. My kids have grown up here. I actually, not many people know this. I had a foot out the door just before I left TFC to go full time with the professional team. When Steve Malik, the new owner, came in, I was having discussions with U.S. Soccer, with Tav Ramos and John Hackworth about being one of John Hackworth's full-time assistants at residency in Florida. Would be an unbelievable experience. And from a professional standpoint, I felt I needed a little bit more, so I was on my way out the door. And then Steve Malik made me an offer to come on full-time with the pro team here, which obviously I ended up taking. And again, the reality is I took it because I love this community and I love being here, and I've already been affiliated with the pro team for 8 years, you know? So if I get an opportunity to do what I do to a greater extent and help this organization even more, the more I thought about it, it was a no-brainer. So, you know, some people would question that, like, well, you had an opportunity to work full-time with the national team. But the reality is this is home. This is home to my family. And this provided me an opportunity to keep working with some tremendous pro players, keep working with a great organization, a great head coach, somebody who shows me a lot of respect and gives me a lot of responsibility. It made sense because, like what you said, if I went and an assistant coach to the national team, what's the next step? I don't know. I'm one of those guys that I work hard at whatever role I have. And if the next role comes on and it makes sense, I'm going to take it. As long as it's involved with soccer, I'm going to take it. You know, right now, what's next? Hopefully we get named as an MLS venue in December. There's a total of 12 markets that have applied. I'm excited, but not really, because all we did was submit an application. You know what I mean? We submitted an application with 12 other people for one job type deal. But the reality is that since then, the moves that Steve Malik has made, the combining of the two youth clubs under our brand, under our umbrella, is a huge one. Getting the women's Courage team here is about to
congratulations to them, by the way, for making it to the finals.
I'm going to go see them play in the championship in Orlando on Saturday. He's on the board of U.S. Soccer. The MLS executives coming in a month or so ago for the rally and unveiling what the stadium would look like and where it would be. I'm super excited now. I think we're one of the few markets that is continuing to move the needle forward, where some of the other ones have dropped off based on whatever it is, not getting the tax bill they were hoping to build a stadium, or not having the land they were hoping to build a stadium, or whatever. To where, you know, I think there's a chance. I don't know how great of a chance, but I think there's a chance. So, you know, if that doesn't happen, I'm happy to continue being a servant to NCFC in my role as an assistant. If at some point I get an opportunity to be the head coach, that would be great as well. If we go MLS, I don't know what my role is, but hopefully there's a role for me here, because I think I put in a lot of work, but I also think I put in a lot of quality work for the pro team, for the youth team, for this community. I think I've had a hand in where soccer is at this point, and hopefully I get a chance to continue moving it on. Let it be.
What is it about this community that makes it the place you're ready to say, you know what, those opportunities are fantastic, but I want to be here?
Yeah.
Besides the family, everybody, I mean.
No, you know, it's a great question. One, I think one is the people.
And I guess that you're selling this to MLS, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It is. It's the people, you know, and a lot of people have relocated from New York, from Maryland. A lot of Northeast influence down here. But, you know, it is the people. It's the friends. It's, you know, like I said, you look at the people who I work with, both the youth side and the pro side. They're guys I've known for a long time and I trust. You know, the people my wife worked for, we trust, we respect them. It's hard to say. You also have the climate, which is a wonderful climate. You have Wake Med Soccer Park, which is my office, which is incredible facilities, you know. But you also have a buzz about soccer. It is a soccer community. I don't care what anybody says. It's a collegiate soccer community. It's a women's soccer community. This is a professional soccer community. If we have an MLS team, we're gonna sell seats. Mm-hmm. And there's history here. It's our history. I go to an NC State game, people still recognize us as the group that played in the Final Four and stuff. So there's a lot here. But overall, we're comfortable and we're happy. And that is the overriding fact. Kurt Johnson, who's our president, when Colin Clark first got the job, and I was an assistant for Martin and I was vying for the job, Kurt said, you may have to go someplace else to get a head coaching job. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want to go anyplace else. You know, I mean, it's true. I mean, I would love to be a head coach, but I love Raleigh more than that. And my family's happy. So their happiness is more important than me being a head coach. As long as I have a role that I find enjoyable, and most of the time that's a teaching role, it's a developmental role, or at least leading a group into the next stages, because I do find that enjoyable, you know, moving something along, and I'm gonna be here for a long time.
And I say that you are emblematic or indicative of the best of what soccer is in this country, from age 5 with that passion to do it, to matriculating through all the levels, to now assistant coach. Is that something you embrace at first? Is that something you identify with? Am I off base with saying something like that? And if I am on point, what is it about your story or your experience that makes you sort of embodiment of American soccer?
I'll say I hope you're not off base, because that was a hell of a compliment. So I'm going to take it.
Take whatever you can get.
I'm going to take it. I'll thank you for it. Now, listen, anybody who knows me knows I'm humble to some extent, but I'm also pretty confident and arrogant. I mean, I think, in fairness, I think I deserve some of those accolades, but I think I've achieved those accolades because I truly love what I do. And it's one of those things where, like, even at the second division, where I don't chase, I've been offered a couple roles in MLS. I don't go chasing them because one of the community, but I actually like the idea of moving players along. If you're already at the top tier, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of fun and excitement about that too. But I like moving these guys along. You know, Nazmi Albadawi, who's our captain with the NCFC right now, I had with the U19. He actually played on that Elmar Bolovich 91 Trang United team that you knew about. He was just a role player on that team. You didn't even know him on that
Mike,
team.
I remember Bjorn. I remember Sonny.
Yeah. Well, Nazmi started his collegiate career at Wake Tech, and then NC State. And then he's a star at NC State, and he's with me with the U19 team. And then with us, listen, if Nazmi's not in MLS next year, then MLS isn't paying attention. And there's going to be nothing that gives me more pride when Nazmi signs that contract, because he embodies all these things that we're talking about. He's a local kid in the community who played soccer and played at State and played for the U23s and played for our pro team. And he's going to play in the MLS someday, without question. That's why I have those accomplishments and those accolades, because those moments are important to me. When Ike Opara went and, you know, third in the draft, that was huge for me. Korede Ayagbasi from NC State, who only played 1 year for me with the U23s, he called me immediately after he got drafted at Sporting Kansas City and said, this would have never happened if it wasn't for the 3 months I spent with you. Those little moments mm-hmm. make you want to do all of this and do it even better. And I'll leave it. And I'll go back to the influence Sonny Askew had on me. That's the influence I want to have on everyone else. I want everybody that's played for me to say, I learned the most from him and it was the most fun.
God damn it, Coach. I'm ready to coach tomorrow. I'm coming tomorrow, 5:30, and see that with the new ambition to... I feel it. I appreciate you giving me the time today to talk about it. I think it's important, not just because of the loss against Trinidad, but I think in talking to you, the gains that are possible in this game and the gains that I know are going to happen under your stewardship, whatever capacity you want to do it in the next couple of years. Looking forward to watching your son develop the next couple of years as well, and to see what NCFC as a pro team and as a club, what we can do in this area, because there's one shield from H5 all the way up to the highest level. So I guess I thank Stephen Malik for putting that investment in the community to do that. And one Wolfpacker to another, man. Appreciate the time. I mean, Dewan Bader was always a name I heard with Henry and I never knew. And then I finally met you and I'm going, all right, I understand. And so, I mean, you're saying it was a cool experience to work with friends, with Alliance, all that stuff. It was a wonderful experience to work with you and watch you embrace what we were trying to do and the way you did it. I really watched it. Picked up a lot. And honestly, man, last 2 hours, I'm ready to coach.
There you go, man.
I'm ready
to go.
Coach. So,
well, there's nothing more enjoyable than having somebody in my new home, in the new kitchen.
By the way, people,
in the kitchen,
get into soccer.
And
soccer can pay.
And talking some soccer.
People,
this
soccer
is the
can
life.
Pay.
This
I'm looking around. I'm looking around right now, and I'm gonna have to do like a 3-6. I'm gonna have to do a 720. There's so much room here. Forget about freaking 3-6. I'm gonna have to do a 720. So maybe I always wanted to do this honestly with you, with Marlo, with Henry when the line stuff first started, and I'm sure. Maybe Henry would find a way. He's never gonna ask for it. But if he hears this and it sounds good,
yeah, now he's gonna want to do it now.
So. Right there.
He's probably on the list. He's probably all teed up and ready to go now. So this will do wonders for you getting Gutierrez.
But appreciate it though.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, man.
That was enjoyable.
Ubuntu Radio is out.